From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents around the globe. I'm Douglas Roberts. On the podcast this week, the Pentagon's questionable allies in Afghanistan, Iraq's new army still dependent on the U.S., the fate of Saddam's spy files, and the oil spills of the Amazon. We begin in Afghanistan. In the push to get supplies to U.S. troops there, the Pentagon is inadvertently lining the pockets of warlords and other unsavory characters. That's the thrust of a new report by congressional investigators who are calling on the military to do a better job of oversight. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
The 79-page report called Warlord Inc. tracks more than $2 billion in contracts covering trucking and security for most of the supplies that reach U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Getting cargo to its destinations in Afghanistan is a tricky endeavor, the report acknowledges. Still, the chairman of a House subcommittee on national security, John Tierney, says the findings are sobering and shocking.
There was really no oversight, certainly insufficient oversight, over about $2.16 billion worth of contracts. And the result of that is that the money may well be fueling a corruption situation where our strategy relies on a government be reliable and that corruption be taken out of the equation.
What happens, Tierney says, is that the U.S. gives contracts to Afghan trucking companies, and they then pay for their own protection. The situation has fueled what the report describes as a shadowy network of warlords, strongmen, and corrupt Afghan officials. Tierney described it as a protection racket that would make Tony Soprano proud.
One estimate was that between $1 million and $2 million a week, in some instances, were going to security contracts by people that weren't vetted and were warlords or other unsavory characters.
The report raises concerns that some money may go to pay off insurgents, not to attack. But Tierney, a Democrat from Massachusetts, says his staff found no smoking gun. He chaired a committee hearing this afternoon where a top Army logistics officer, Lieutenant General William Phillips, described how important the host nation trucking contract is.
Through the host nation trucking contract, more than 90% of our forces in Afghanistan received food, water, equipment, ammunition, construction materials, and other badly needed supplies.
He says he takes seriously the allegations that the contracts are fueling corruption and warlordism. Another Pentagon official said a new Defense Department task force is already trying to get a better handle on how U.S. taxpayer dollars are flowing through Afghanistan. Moshe Schwartz of the Congressional Research Service says the Pentagon has done a better job of overseeing its contracts, but still has a ways to go. He says there are about 16,000 armed security contractors, most of them Afghans, and vetting them is key to U.S. strategy.
That is one of the concerns that has been raised by a number of analysts, which is who are these people that are being hired by the Department of Defense to provide private security? To the extent that the local population does not look kindly on those individuals, that could hurt our effort to win hearts and minds.
Another analyst says the problem isn't just a contracting issue, but the strategy the U.S. is pursuing. Frederick Starr, who runs the Central Asia Caucasus Institute at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, says so far the U.S. is only worried about transporting military goods, so the Afghans who want to help are only the ones the U.S. pays off.
We don't have the local people interested in keeping the roads open. The minute we are the ones opening roads for their use as well as for our use, they become partners in the enterprise, and they will be the first to stand out there with their Kalashnikovs when the Taliban tries to close the road.
Starr says the U.S. military has shown some interest in a report he recently issued about ways to revive the ancient trade routes through Afghanistan. But today's hearing focused on the more narrow question of getting supplies to the U.S. military without promoting corruption and undermining U.S. strategy. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Now to Iraq. The American pullout is picking up pace, and that's good news for U.S. troops stationed there who are eager to head home. But many Iraqi soldiers have come to rely on American largesse to keep their facilities running. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports from Baghdad.
Major General Baha Nuri Yassin is the head of the Basra Brigade, which is under the direct supervision of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. In theory, he should be able to get whatever he wants for his men. He shows a visiting reporter around his pristine new headquarters.
This is the chow hall for the officers, for the policemen.
The grounds are impeccable, the buildings newly painted. But the large facility is not the result of any money from Iraq's Ministry of Interior. Rather, the American military paid about $600,000 to refurbish the property.
I should be honest with you. You know the facts. I get everything from the American. What I need, I just ask the American, and it's easy to get everything from the American.
As the U.S. pullout picks up speed, Iraq's security services, which have been relying on Americans for years, are now being left in the lurch.
We are complaining from the shortage in the money because we have no budget at all in our division and even in the federal police. If we want something, we should ask, you know, the MOI to send us some money, and it takes a long time.
General Baha has been in possession of this property for over a year, but it's still largely unoccupied. The generator donated by the Iraqi government doesn't work, and in any case, there's no money for fuel. And there's only about 1 hour of electricity out of seven from the city power grid. To get everything up to scratch, General Baha has had to dig into his own coffers.
By the way, I paid many times from my pockets.
Really?
Yeah.
Iraq earns billions of dollars in oil revenue a month, but still the security services and other Iraqi agencies here still depend on U.S. help. And that's not the only reason some here are beginning to miss the Americans. Many here say they mistrust Iraq's security forces. In the mainly Sunni Baghdad district of Adamiyah, Iraqis scurry from shaded patch to covered awning, trying to escape the oppressive afternoon heat. Recently, the leader of a local paramilitary organization called the Sons of Iraq was assassinated here. Ziad Tariq Nouri is a 33-year-old shop owner who witnessed the killing. He says he believes the security forces colluded in the murder.
Usually, there would be an Iraqi army Humvee parked in front of the coffee shop where the victim sat. But on that day, the Humvee was not there.
Ziad says Iraq's security services are now feared here.
When they search a house, we do not feel safe. When they detain someone, we panic because we don't know why our young men are taken or to where.
Lowering his voice, he says that security was better under the Americans.
Americans used to patrol this street, and they would come asking what we need. Iraqi soldiers don't pay attention to us. They just talk on their cell phones, ignoring our needs.
By and large, the U.S. withdrawal is popular here. American operations have left thousands of civilians dead or wounded. Most Iraqis still feel that their country is under occupation, even though tens of thousands of soldiers have pulled out over the past year. But many here, like Ziad, say, it's better the devil you know than the devil you don't. And there is a real fear about what happens after the last American soldier leaves. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Baghdad.
7 years after the fall of Saddam Hussein's regime, Iraq is still trying to win the return of voluminous records and archives compiled for Saddam's Ba'ath Party, many of which are currently held in the U.S. Some Iraqis say those millions of documents hold the key to national reconciliation, but others warn that Iraq may not be ready to unlock these secrets of betrayal and brutality. NPR's Peter Kenyon recently returned from Baghdad, and he sent this report.
46-year-old Riyad al-Rabai has a vivid memory from 2003. As the Iraqi government vanished, people scrambled to loot the files of Saddam's secret police from various offices tucked around Baghdad. In one, he came across a man standing stock still amid the chaos, a file in one hand, tears streaming down his face.
He just kept sobbing. Is it possible? Is it possible? He was holding the file of his brother, a member of the Communist Party, who was arrested in 1979. And he'd just learned that the people who had informed on his brother, the people who got him executed, were his own cousin and brother-in-law.
Growing up in a tough neighborhood of Sadr City, Rubai thought of himself as an Iraqi and a Muslim and a supporter of Saddam Hussein. But after fighting for his country in the war against Iran, Rubai came back to find Saddam had jailed, tortured, and killed many Iraqis at home. he started to become politicized. He took part in one anti-Saddam demonstration, and he and his friends would gather at night and talk about what they'd like to do to the Ba'athists if they ever got the chance. Then, without warning, the secret police raids began. His friends were arrested, and he only just escaped with his uncle. Years later, he realized how the regime had ferreted out his barely formed political views. A prominent Ba'athist had been using his sisters to glean information from the women and children in the neighborhood.
They'd go to a wedding and chat with all the women. The same for funerals. You might see them by the front gate all day, watching who goes where and who's talking with whom.
Much of the paper trail from Saddam's decades of spying was badly damaged in the post-invasion looting, and millions of documents were spirited away to the U.S., where they remain. A slender, soft-spoken Iraqi named Saad Iskander is trying to change that. Iskander is the director of the Iraqi National Library and Archives. Last month, he showed a reporter around his aging facility and the new modern building being constructed next door. He has a young staff of restorers trained in the latest conservation techniques from Europe. They're painstakingly freezing, drying, and restoring documents, in this case from the Ottoman era. The archives are also being digitized and made available on the Internet. Iskander's quiet librarian's demeanor hides a fierce belief in the power of information to imprison a society or free it.
So it's from a closed society to an open society. This is our slogan.
I can see how this would make some people from the Ba'ath Party a little nervous.
Yes, not only the Ba'ath Party, all the extremists from the left and the right is not happy about this, I would call it a democratization of information.
Iskander says it's crucial to retrieve the spy files as soon as possible because it will take years for Iraq to recover from the effects of a spying operation of staggering pervasion and brutality.
You are spied on by your neighbors, by your work colleagues, by your fellow students at university. Every Iraq was spied on. Even those who were part of the regime and had close links to the regime. So the leaders of the regime lived in permanent paranoia.
Perhaps understandably, Iskander says there has never been a dictatorship like Saddam's. But other countries might dispute that. The Oscar-winning 2007 film, The Lives of Others, explored the institutionalized spying of the East German Stasi. In this scene, the main character, a famous East German playwright, sits in a research room after the fall of the Berlin Wall, leafing through his own surveillance files. As he turns the pages, the playwright comes to see himself not as a human being, but as a case, codenamed Laszlo, and there is pain but not surprise in his face as he reads how his lover, before she committed suicide, was forced repeatedly to betray him.
Bei dem Besuch handelt es sich Paul Hausers Onkel aus West-Berlin.
Critics say The Lives of Others is a compelling glimpse into the way a repressive spying apparatus, over time, eats away at the social fabric holding a community together. Saad Iskander says this is what happened to Iraq. Yes, he says, it was naive of America to believe its soldiers would be welcomed by Iraqis instantly ready to build a democratic society, and the reasons why are buried in the spy files.
So the collapse of the regimes, it was not a political collapse, it was a social collapse as well. The invasion just opened the gate for all of the bad phenomena that took roots under Saddam Hussein.
There is considerable debate, both inside and outside of Iraq, about what to do with the spy archives. Many were collected by the Iraq Memory Foundation, a U.S.-funded project dedicated to helping Iraqis come to terms with the atrocities committed under Saddam. The foundation turned the files over to the Hoover Institution at Stanford University to be digitized. The U.S. government, which under President Bush initially took a keen interest in the Ba'ath Party files, is now adopting a hands-off approach. Philip Frayne is a spokesman for the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad.
This should be the subject of discussion between Hoover and the Iraqi Memory Foundation and the Iraqi government. In other words, they're in the custody of the Hoover Institution right now, not in the custody of the U.S. government.
But what would it mean for a still-struggling Iraqi society if the secret police files were suddenly revealed? For the Memory Foundation, those files can be a powerful tool for reconciliation and healing if they're handled properly. The Foundation's Hassan Manene, in a 2005 NPR interview, said other countries have taken a variety of approaches, some of which he views as extreme, such as South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
This is an extreme model where basically victim and perpetrator face each other. Another extreme model, far closer to Iraq, is the Lebanese model. A traumatic civil war ends, a page is turned as if nothing has actually happened. This is a model almost of denial. Between these two extremes, we believe, Iraqi society is going to try to find its level of comfort. And our role is clearly to advocate for one that is more towards openness.
But put that same question to Iraqis who were victims of Saddam's spying regime, like Riyad al-Rubai, and you get a very different answer. When asked whatever happened to the Ba'athist who used to spy on Rubai's neighborhood, he calmly slides a finger across his throat. He says this is not Germany, and Iraq isn't ready to have decades of betrayal revealed all at once.
For us Iraqis, our tribal nature is still prevailing. Our democracy is too new. There would be killing in the streets.
Given the issues of preservation and politics still to be worked through, Iraqis are likely to have quite a bit of time before they know if and when the spy files will return. Then Iskander may find out if the information Saddam used to wound a nation can also help to heal it. Peter Kenyon, NPR News.
Coming up, oil spills in the Amazon.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Douglas Roberts. We're going to take you now to Peru's Amazon region and a controversy over oil drilling. Last summer, indigenous protesters clashed with police. Dozens were killed. They were protesting government decrees that would open up to development more of the Amazon rainforest. Peru's government made the decision to do that without consulting those living in the region. 1 year later, there's a new law which requires consultation, but it still hasn't gone into effect. So more oil concessions are now open for bidding, and the indigenous people are again upset. Annie Murphy has this report.
Here in the middle of the Peruvian Amazon, thousands of miles from the BP oil spill pouring into the Gulf of Mexico, oil spills have been a fact of life for over 30 years. Today, the local Achuar indigenous people are constantly sick. Fainting spells, vomiting, chronic diarrhea, headaches, and skin infections are common problems in villages like San Cristobal. The Achuar believe it's because of oil. Isaac Sandy is 25 years old. He's tall and shy and got married last year. He has frequent headaches, and every other day he gets an injection to relieve the symptoms of an unknown skin condition. If he doesn't get the shot, his skin breaks out in a spotty white rash and his entire body swells.
There's a stream where we always go to fish, and it's always had oil on top. We catch the fish there and eat them. The fish drink the water, and since we eat them, the oil must get into us that way.
This riverside village of open-air wood and thatch homes is remote, and research is seldom carried out here. But government doctor Alan Castro thinks health problems in San Cristobal have causes other than oil.
Una de las enfermedades específicas y prevalentes acá es una la desnutrición crónica.
Dr. Castro says he believes it can almost all be explained by malnutrition, which has become widespread here. But a Peruvian government study published in 2006 found that most indigenous people along this river, the Rio Corrientes, had unhealthy levels of lead in their blood. And over 95% were over the healthy limit for cadmium. Lead and cadmium are associated with oil spills, which have been happening here for decades. Whether the cause of these health problems is oil spills, other changes brought by outsiders, or a combination of the two, the Achuar's quality of life has worsened since oil companies arrived, and little is being done to help them. A sawmill is set up in the bustling town of Trompeteros. Trompeteros is the base of operations for the company currently in this area, Argentine-owned Pluspetrol. The town has electricity, running water and sewage systems, phone service, even internet. But a few minutes downriver, next to Pluspetrol's paved runway, the village of San Cristobal doesn't even have electricity. The roof of the local school is literally caving in. Daniel Walinga, the village elder, says, "We've asked the company to help out and they tell us they have nothing, that the oil revenue is running low." About a dozen students sit on plywood benches in a house that serves as a makeshift school. Students study in Spanish and the indigenous Achuar language. During music class, they learn Achuar songs, which are traditionally sung to their gardens, to their animals, and to the forest. Like their parents, most of the kids here suffer from the chronic stomach aches, fainting, vomiting, and fevers. Some also have developmental problems. Peruvian oil analyst Aurelio Ochoa says that spills are an unavoidable part of the oil business.
Son, digamos, obras humanas al final, ¿no? Entonces pueden tener algún riesgo. Siempre tienen un riesgo, cualquier operación, ¿no?
These are human Entonces, projects, he says, so there will always be a risk, as clean as the operation might be. Accidents happen, and they're going to keep on happening, here, in Alaska, in Louisiana, wherever. The point is, he says, companies should be held responsible. But the dense foliage and river labyrinths of the Amazon are a world away from the capital of Lima and the legal system, according to human rights lawyer Miguel Hugo.
Los pueblos indígenas siempre han sufrido de parte del Estado.
Indigenous people have always suffered from inaction on the part of the state. Their rights are constantly violated. If the state starts to consult with indigenous people, the state will become responsible for meeting their requests. And the government does not want that.
When indigenous communities began to take a stand against big companies operating in their territory, President Alan Garcia wrote an editorial criticizing their position. He used the fable, The Dog and the Manger, to make his point. In the story, a dog falls asleep in a manger and wakes up to bark at the cows who want to eat the hay, even though the dog himself can't eat the stuff. The moral of the story is, don't begrudge others something you can't enjoy yourself. The hay was Peru's natural riches, and in the editorial, President Garcia compared the spiteful dog to Peru's indigenous people. Plus Petrol declined a comment for this story, as did the Peruvian state-owned oil company. In response to an interview request, Environment Minister Antonio Brack released a statement saying oil drilling will not destroy the Amazon rainforest, and that Peru must also worry about its energy security. He notes that Peru does need to, quote, improve the participation of local communities. Today, oil regulations are tighter. But in San Cristobal, relations between the Achuar, the oil company, and the Peruvian state are getting worse. Ana Walinga stands in a clearing surrounded by stumps in what was, until recently, a garden and tree nursery. She explains in heated Achuar how a few weeks ago the oil company raised and appropriated this community plot to expand their airport without consulting the people who farm it. Nearby, huge black helicopters rise out of the jungle at regular intervals, drowning out all other sounds, then sweeping off into the distance. For now, the Achuar are doing the best they can to keep tabs on the oil company themselves. Wilson Sandy works for an indigenous monitoring program that tracks oil spills.
Up through March of this year, we registered 3 serious spills and 2 smaller ones. The earth here is contaminated and it will never be completely healthy again. Never.
Oil analyst Aurelio Ochoa says that the future of this place will depend on who puts down the money to control it. Be it big business or
environmentalists.
Remember, Peru has natural resources and it's looking to develop its economy. If ecological conservation were profitable, we could do that. But who is going to step up to it?
For the moment, much of this mythic ecosystem is still a vast green expanse of rivers, plant life, animals, and people. Like the Achuar, for whom the Amazon is not a conservation project or an economic bonanza, but home. For NPR News, this is Annie Murphy in Iquitos, Peru.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Roberts.